On the culture of excellence piece, I feel like we just sometimes don't take it far enough. The teams that go completely to the end of it and then start to live that and accept that and move through it, I believe will be the most successful ones in the end.
That's Canadian Olympic coach Mel Davidson, and this is Difference Makers, a Christina Walker podcast. This week's guest is Mel Davidson. Mel coached the Canadian women's hockey team to a gold medal in both the 2006 and 2010 Olympics. She's an inductee in the Canadian Olympic Hall of Fame and later the general manager of the women's Canadian hockey team. Now, if you want to hear from someone who really knows what they're talking about, then this is the person to do so. Our conversation touches on team culture, leadership, and what a team of excellence really looks like. Before we get started, this podcast is sponsored by Marathon Surfaces, suppliers of rubberized surfacing for running tracks, sport venues, walking paths, and safety surfacing for playgrounds. Let's begin the conversation with Mel Davidson. Hello.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon, whatever time it is where you're at.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm good.
How are things going?
Good. My sewer backed up this weekend, so I'm got the real life stuff going on. But other than that, can't complain.
Nice. Awesome. First, thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me. Matt, I was talking about it. So he's our strength and conditioning coach. I don't know how much you know about me, but I'm on the rowing team here in Victoria. I'm training towards the Olympics this summer. And so I have Matt as a strength and conditioning coach, and I started this podcast about 2 months ago now, and I'm always looking for inspiring people and people that I can kind of connect and try to express their story and share it to the world, so or whoever wants to listen to the podcast. So you were the first person that came to mind for him, so I was very excited to have you on the podcast.
Interesting. Usually I come to people's minds for the wrong reason, but anyway.
I doubt that that's true.
I guess the one question I have for you is why, with all your training and everything going on in the pandemic, why jump into the podcast world?
Yeah, totally. So I joined the national team last year, fall of 2019. I was at school at UBC. And I was very active in a lot of different avenues at school, within athletics. I'm very passionate about not just my sport of rowing, but also, the impact that sport has on community, on the environment that you're in. And so I was very involved at school, and then I found myself coming to the national team and being very one-dimensionally focused. And during that time and that was last year for about 8 months, it taught me a lot. One thing that I learned was that I needed other things in my life in order to find that I could have my best performance in the boat, on the water, so, which I think athletes learn to categorize things. And at that time, I was everything was rowing. And then I found that I was having too much focus on that sport and not actually being able to fully enjoy the process of being there. And so this year, I really love podcasts. I listen to podcasts all the time. And I felt like I've been around quite a few very impactful people in my life, and I wanted to share their stories. So that was another side of it. I wanted to add something to my life that wasn't just about rowing, but maybe could also help me in my sport moving forward, kind of on the mental side of things. Yeah. And share these conversations with people that I get to have.
Cool. Yeah, it's interesting. The very first part you said about you needed more than just the rowing. I wish more athletes would pick up on that. I know there, like, the athletes I've worked with, there's only been a handful that have had that self-awareness. So that's a pretty good trait.
Thanks. No, I think it's so interesting because when I first joined the sport back in 2015, then I fell in love with it so quickly. So I came to UBC for cross country and track, and then I started on the novice program. And with rowing, it's kind of cool because it's kind of a late entry sport as well. So you have people who are joining in at an early age, but then also people who are joining in their 20s or late 20s. And and then going to the Olympics for the sport. But at the time and I've kind of had this progression throughout my career, which is like, I thought in order to be the best at something, you have to devote your entirety to it, which I think you do, but there's a certain way of navigating it and realizing that other things in your life can attribute to that success, and finding other passions to devote yourself, and then being able to bring that back into those learnings that you learn, bring them back into your sport. And so it's helped me along my way. And I've had times where I'm fully focused on rowing and it hasn't treated me the best that I thought that it would. And other times where I'm doing other things and I actually find that I'm performing better. So,
right. We've had one of our players who didn't quite break the senior level bubble, Shannon McCauley. Mm-hmm. She got identified through the RBC training ground in rowing.
Oh, really?
I don't know. I think she's still at a lower level, but you talked about the lateness of it. Like, she played university hockey and was like mid-20s when the RBC mm-hmm. stuff came around. So it is definitely a sport you can join at any point in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's really cool that way. So I guess my kind of first question for you was, what drew you to the sport of hockey?
Well, you know what? It's not even my first passion, which people find always funny. Softball and swimming were things that I really would have loved to have dived into. I don't really know, to be honest. I wanted to play where I grew up, and the time that I grew up, girls didn't play hockey. My brother was playing like under seven and unders, and somehow I ended up on the ice helping to coach him. And then I was in grade 8 at that point, so 14 or 15, and it just went from there. I mean, I've always loved sports. I always knew I wanted to do something in sports. Mm-hmm. And as far as the coaching piece, I think one thing just led to another on that route. And then growing up in a small town, I played all the sports. And in most small towns, if you play it, you end up coaching it. And I've just evolved and been real fortunate enough to make a career out of it from there, which I think a lot of people, especially when I started, it really wasn't a vision, or you wouldn't have seen that you could.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you decide to coach?
Well, always had coached. And then in 1996, I was a recreation director in a small town in Castor, Alberta. And I just one day decided I needed something else. I felt like I'd spent 10 years building that, and I didn't know how much further I could go there. Always coaching minor sports. So they were generous enough to give me a year's leave of absence mm-hmm. to attend the National Coaching Institute in Calgary. And just in that year, those 8 or 9 months, like I knew that I had to take a chance and look to becoming a full-time coach. At that time, there was no full-time coaching positions for women in hockey in Canada. So I looked into the U.S. and I ended up taking a coaching position at Connecticut College, a Division III school, as the assistant coach of women's volleyball and head coach of women's hockey. And, you know, the pay was basically nothing. So it was a big step, but, I'm really glad I did it. And I still wish over time I would have had more of an opportunity to coach full time for a school or an organization, but that's not the way it was at that point in time.
Mm-hmm. And during that time, did you have any sort of like kind of resentment or feeling like this shouldn't be that way and you wanted to change that? Or was it just something that you just were in it and it was like, there aren't any other opportunities, so I have to just go somewhere? Or was it more like, I need to change this? Because you've obviously changed quite a bit of that sort of like culture, I'd say, out of my research, is like your impact has been pretty tremendous on not even just hockey, but in sport in general and having those female roles. So yeah, what was your kind of mindset back then?
Well, when I made that switch, it definitely was an individual mindset. Like, I just want to coach full time. Mm-hmm. Because of the fact that I was always in a small center in a small town, I wasn't necessarily always connected with what was happening in the big world, if you will. So, you know, at that point in time, it was just like, back then I was in my 30s. So I was like, I'm getting up there. I have to go, you know, I want to coach full time. I've got to do it now or I won't be able to do it. You know, over time, especially from the Connecticut College time, and then I was selected as an assistant coach for the 2002 Olympics and coming back. And I would say after 2002, then I started to get more frustrated about the fact that, you know, I coached in the Olympics, we won a gold medal, and I have no job. And then, you know, I went back to the States, Cornell University, and loved it. It was a phenomenal opportunity, and I enjoyed every single minute of that. And then came back again in 06 for the 06 Olympics. And, you know, at the same point in time, if I would have left Hockey Canada, there was no job opportunities again. But was fortunate enough that Hockey Canada put me on full-time through to Vancouver. But, you know, it's sort of that, I would say, 2000 to 2010 part of my life where, like, this has got to change. We've got to be different. People, you shouldn't, you know, you watch your male counterparts and they coach Team Canada to gold medals or not, and they still go back to professional jobs and paychecks. And after every Olympics, for me, it was the same thing. I didn't know how I was going to pay my bills. Wow. So, you know, those were tough times. But I would say that 10-year span is when I really started to take a look outside of myself as to what was really happening and how do we make it better for others.
Mm-hmm. And how would you describe, like, when you were coaching, like at Cornell or kind of like the, it's different, right? It's like a university coaching and then you're going now Olympic coaching. Did you find that there was a change in your coaching during, either of those programs, or did you feel like you're kind of a consistent, like your philosophies didn't really change when you were jumping programs like that pretty quickly?
No, I was always consistent. Things didn't shift for me. I was always about process, preparation, and details, and then the relationship. So, I mean, there's managing expectations depending on whether you're working with seven and unders, you know, university Olympians. But in what I expected in terms of standards, behaviors, respect for each other, nothing like that ever changed.
What are those sort of expectations and values that you lay out to those teams when you first join?
Well, for sure, the respect amongst each other, like to treat each other the way you would want to be treated, you know, is huge. Communication pieces, not letting things like go to the explosion level, like having those conversations and being able to talk through scenarios or situations, how we got to that point, what happened, like how do we make sure that, you know, we respect the way we should manage that. So a lot on the relationship and communication side, standards of behavior. You know, I always talk about, you know, how, you know, what would you want someone to tell your parents about you if they only met you once? You know, right. Your family or those types of things. And then, you know, when it transfers to the, you know, the workout / competition side, like work ethic, you know, and respect for the opponent and the ability to have a, you know, an open mindset to continue to grow and get better within the team environment. I think that the team environment is challenging because of all the different personalities you have and the different motivations for people being there and just everything. You know, that's the one piece is probably a little bit different at the Olympic level, is that generally at that level, everybody is there for the same reason. Mm-hmm. But what motivates them is completely different from person to person. Whereas, you know, college, university, there's a variety of reasons why people are playing. They may have always done it. You know, I got the scholarship so I could go to school. So, you know, I'm going to play and get my education, but that's as far as I'm going to go. So you're dealing with different levels of whys there, the why they play. Whereas at the Olympic level, it's really the why is there. They want to be the best they can be at the highest possible level generally. Mm-hmm. And it's more about, you know, what motivates them to get to that level and how you can help them.
Right. And do you think that's a good frame of mind to think about? Like, for myself personally, I try to investigate, like, is it the best way for me to think I want to be the best athlete I can be, the best person I can be? Or should I be thinking like, I want to devote myself to this higher goal, and commit everything to Team Canada and do what I need to do in order to make that team go there and perform the best that they can? Or do you think you should be thinking more on like that individualistic level of like, I want to be the best version of myself? And maybe those two things coincide with each other.
I believe they do. I always call it a balanced ego. Like, to be a successful athlete or person, you have to have an ego. Like, you just,
right,
you can't survive if you don't have an ego, because that's kind of what helps you put all the pieces together sometimes. But it has to be balanced. And in the end, you have to give of yourself to the higher goal, which is the team outcome or the team performance. So, you know, being able to understand the fact of what drives you, what's your moments of excellence and how you get there, and keeping that balance with how does that fit in with the way the team will get there? Because sometimes within the team, you may be a superstar on every other team you've been at, but now you're a third or fourth liner, or you're a role player, or you're the alternate on the relay team or whatever it might be. Right. Totally. So you have to shift your thinking there as to how can I be my best there and be ready to contribute in whatever that looks like. So for me, the balanced ego, being able to manage that, is huge.
Mm-hmm. And on the teams that you've had the most success, like the gold medal teams, have you seen that everyone is kind of doing that or participating in that way?
Definitely. But it is a shared responsibility. Like coaches just can't expect their athletes to bring that. You have to share that responsibility. Like, you have to value each and every one of your athletes and what they bring, and help them understand that, help them sort through the bad days when they don't want to be that alternate or they don't want to be that role player, and take them back to their why. And, you know, generally it's because they love being with their teammates and they love playing the sport. Mm-hmm. And then it's working through that. So there's a shared responsibility between the leadership, both in terms of athlete leadership and the coaches and the leaders within the program, to ensure that you're valuing what everybody brings on a consistent basis.
Mm-hmm. And your role as a coach, do you find that, 'cause I think I've had so many different coaches over the years, and some are very, where I would say I can see that there's like that hierarchy. So I see that they're above me, and then others where I see that they're there right there with me, and they're trying to work with me the entire process. And it's more of like back and forth communication, and it's not just that they know best, but they're trying to figure out what we know and using that. Is that kind of more your philosophy, or how have you navigated being in those roles of, especially when you're the coach and you're dealing with however many players? Like, at a certain point, you're the one that's putting out the program, you're the one that's telling them what to do. How do you still want to be on that mutual respect for each other?
Well, it is an evolution. I'm definitely not perfect, and on any given day I can screw it up. But, you know, I think the important piece there for the coach to understand is that, and the athlete, is somebody has to make a final decision. So as much as you can share back and forth there, especially in team sports, you're never going to satisfy 25 athletes or 23 athletes. So listening, hearing, having clarity around where you want to go and what that looks like is important. And then, you know, I always adapted the phases. Sometimes we just have to agree to disagree, that for you personally, this might not be the best, you know, path or road, but for the team as a whole, it's probably going to take us further than just an individual path. So, I mean, those are real big growing points, and it's so important, you know, your leadership group, whoever your group of leaders within a team structure, you know, that's who you really have to work with, because they have to be your voice outside of that, to not to help change people's mind, but help them see the vision and give of themselves, if you will, to the team that way. But, you know, I would say I got okay at it, and at times pretty good at it, but it's a constant evolution as a coach. And sometimes you have athletes that are extremely mature and it flows beautifully. And that's the ideal piece. Sometimes it's a challenge and at times drama central every day, because you just struggle to get the balance between what the why is individually and what the why is as a team. But that's where, you know, clear goals, a good foundation, talking through things, consistency in behavior. So it doesn't matter if in hockey, say, if you're the one scoring every goal or if you're not, I still, as a coach, we value you the same way. Mm-hmm. And then I think the beauty of a coaching staff, in hockey anyway, and in a lot of team sports, is that there is a bit of hierarchy with the head coach because they're kind of in the middle, right? They report to the organization, they report to the players, and they still got to lead everybody down the right path. And your assistant coaches are very valuable in being able to help with those communications. Like you said, so an athlete, you know, isn't in a certain role that they want to be within the team, the assistant coach would be probably the one that would, okay, what's the path? What's our goals here? Let's work together to become the better you. Not that the head coach doesn't value it or wouldn't do it, but sometimes they just don't have enough time to do every individual. And that's the, you know, the beauty of having a in-sync coaching staff, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. And what were kind of the dynamics on those gold medal winning teams? Did you find that really brought you to that success?
Gosh, every one of them was so completely different.
Really?
So completely different. Like, you know, 2002, it would have been rallying around the fact that we hadn't beat the U.S. at all that whole season. You know, we were 0-7 or 0-8 going into the gold medal game on their home ground. So rallying around a sort of a theme of, well, why not us? Who cares, you know? So, you know, there's that type of thing. The 2006 group was outstanding. We had phenomenal leadership with our captains and assistants, and it was a real fun year. And my assistants were just like I described there. They were terrific that way. You know, 2010 was a real interesting group. We had a lot of veterans, a lot of people that had experienced the 06 Olympics. So they were, you know, on that verge of moving into more leadership roles, but still not maybe wanting to take full accountability. Mm-hmm. And then a whole flock of tremendous talent coming up. So, you know, we are constantly in a pull and tug. And, you know, 2010 was sort of the evolution of digital media, social media, all of those pieces, which I'm sure seems funny to you, but it was, you know, kind of the emergence of that. Mm-hmm. We're incredibly talented, lots of strong personalities. So it was a constant discussions and reshaping and talking and growing as a group throughout, you know, 2014, we went through a coaching change. So shifting again, you know, in 2018, we had a lot of ups and downs and just made a couple bad decisions in the gold medal game. Right. So, yeah, every team's a bit different. You got to be willing to flex and go on that different journey and pull the pieces out that have worked, but realize you're dealing with different people every time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I feel like there's, especially in sport and at that level, is like there's changes that are happening so frequently, and the teams that seem to have the most success are able to kind of face that adversity, acknowledge it, and then move past it the best way possible. And I can see that within your time as a coach. And how is that transition going from coaching then to general manager?
I mean, it's good. The toughest piece, and if I had to redo that piece, is you have to give your coaches lots of room. So, I mean, you have a vision and a focus, a foundation, the organization has one. How you connect those dots is something that, you know, I learned a lot along the way, and I'd be much better at it now if I had to do it again. Because for so many years I was the GM and the head coach, right? So it was all connecting.
Oh, wow.
So it's getting that foundation built. Like you always need to, like, people talk a lot about the vision, the mission, the values, all of that. And it takes a lot of time to bring a group of individuals together on that. Mm-hmm. But you have to do it. So in the bad times, you've always got it to fall back on. And I would say we could have spent more time letting the coach, or not letting, but having the coaches and the staff spend more time in that realm. And I don't believe it wasn't they didn't value it. I probably didn't give them enough space to do that properly.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that was more easily accessible when you were in both of those roles? It sounds like there was more freedom because if you're the coach and general manager, yeah, then you're kind of orchestrating the entirety of the process. Whereas like you add in more roles, then now you're dealing with getting those people on board of that vision.
Yeah, definitely. There's that piece. You know, there's still kind of that mantra out there. Like, I just want to coach, you know, and sometimes it's the buy-in to the fact that coaching isn't just sport specific.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of pieces there, and that taking away from the sport specific training or work right now will allow you to do that nonstop moving forward. And there's just always different viewpoints and pathways that people go down to do that. And sometimes I think that gets in the way. We just don't spend enough time on what that foundation is. And then when things go sideways, we don't go back to the foundation. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't start at the beginning again and say, where did we lose it? Where did we go? How did we miss that? You know, we just try to fix whatever the problem is. And sometimes we don't connect the dots to the foundation that we spent lots of time building, or we didn't spend a lot of time building it. And then when the shit hits the fan, we don't have anything to fall back on. We're scrambling, treading water.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of those attributes of that really strong foundation that you experienced?
Well, you know, every group's different, but integrity, I mean, clarity in your communication, identification of roles and responsibilities, like how that all works. You know, trust, building trust, the, you know, perseverance. I mean, every group's a bit different on how the passion, and that's why it's so important that you can't, like, a coach or a GM can't drive that down. Mm-hmm. Like, people have to work through it and know their why and know what sets them off and what makes them excited. And then you build up from that. And a lot of times, you know, coaches tend to, they do the meetings themselves or staffs, including myself. And you come up with what the foundation is as a group, and you're telling the athletes versus leading them through a process. So everybody understands what it means. Like if I say, Christina, you're not working hard enough. Mm-hmm. Right now, you wouldn't know what I meant for sure. Like, you'd have your own definition of working hard. I'd have my own definition. But going through that process allows you to talk through what is working hard look like. Mm-hmm. So that if I say, Christina, you're not working hard enough, you know what that means. And you know, it's not an attack on you personally.
Yeah.
It's that something in your actions or behaviors needs to change. And if you're not clear, we've already established our relationship and our communication lines to have that discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so interesting. And honestly, I see that apply quite a bit in probably across all sports, but especially just because where I am right now too, having those conversations. And I had somebody else on the podcast before, and they're saying that there's no room for elephants in the room at the Olympics. And it's so true. And even we're seeing that now, where it's just like, if you have a thought on your mind and you think that that's going to be impactful moving forward, then might as well say it, and let's not take offense to what's going on. And we're in a boat where we're all trying to be moving together. And it, like, I mean, it's just like you guys on the ice, and you need to have that communication and work on those skills that allow you to know exactly what that person is doing behind you, how they're feeling, how you're able to react to that, to what they're saying, and vice versa for the people in front of you as well. And the only way of doing that is to communicate. Do you find that also plays a role then in culture when you talk about how it's very much like the team rising up? I think about culture as like the players themselves or the athletes themselves. They have a major role and they're the ones that are setting the culture. But then at the same time, it's also those heads of the organization that can come down top down. But I wonder what your perspective is on that. Like, where do you think culture is most influenced by?
I feel like it's influenced by everybody. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel like in today's world, the decision-making piece gets forgotten though. Like, we spend a lot of time talking about the culture of excellence and the importance of it and what the standards are, whatever forms your culture of excellence. But sometimes, like, it, you can have a consensus, but somebody still has to make the final decision. Mm-hmm. And lots of times I feel like people, organizations, teams, they have the talk. They talk about the standards. They talk about what it's going to look like, how we're going to act, how we're going to behave, but nobody closes the door on it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, nobody says, okay, here's where we are. Here's what the definitions are, and continue to work through those steps until everybody's like, okay, I can live with that. We spend a lot of time trying to get everybody to agree with it, and not everybody's going to, especially on a team, not everybody is going to agree 100% on it. That's like, it's impossible to get, like, so in hockey, you know, our organization, our team would have 40 people between staff and athletes. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely no way that everybody can say, in all honesty and sincerity, that all 40 people would agree on every little piece of everything, right? So getting to a common ground and making sure we're at a point where, you know, when I get up in the morning, I can look in the mirror and I'm still good with what we're going to do.
Right.
You know, even if it's only, you know, there's something that I still agree with it. It's maybe not as important to me as it is to you. But I still think it, I can see why it should be a part of our culture. And I sometimes feel like that's the gap, is it gets talked about and we get to a certain point and then we forget to close the door on it completely and say, yeah, we're all in. And we acknowledge that everybody's all in at a different percentage level, but you're all in.
Right.
You know, when something happens, you're not going to be like, well, I didn't agree with that to begin with. Mm. You know, it's like, no, we're in. Like, that's what we decided we would do as a group. And on the culture of excellence piece, I feel like we just sometimes don't take it far enough. The teams that go the completely to the end of it and then start to live that and accept that and move through it, I believe will be the most successful ones in the end.
Right. So do you mean like taking accountability for those actions?
Yeah, but let's just take today's world, the masks.
Yeah.
Gotta wear masks, right? Mm-hmm. So you go into a training environment on a day, like everybody knows the coaches aren't like pushing it down on you. Everybody knows your teammates aren't pushing it on you. We just, that's the world we're in right now. Mm. So if I walk into the training environment and don't wear my mask, why should a teammate have to remind me? Why should, like, we know that's what, that's our behavior that we all have to live with.
Yeah.
Whether we agree or disagree. Right. Mm-hmm. So, but then you walk in without the mask on and now the therapist is upset because it's endangering people and everybody on your team takes it to another level. Somebody might have a family member that's immune comp, you know, and now you're putting them at risk. But we've all agreed that it's out of our hands. We can't control it. But yet you walk in without your mask on. Mm. So, you know, that for me is and it can spin through different things, whether it's being on time, whether it's talking to a teammate. You got an issue with a teammate, just sitting down and having the conversation, like having the difficult conversations, like, you know, just have those conversations before they become really difficult. Mm-hmm. So those are the pieces that I'm talking about, because in doing that, you build trust. Like, I trust that the only way for us to get out of quarantine is if everybody isolates for the 14 days and then we're free, you know, which is a lot of pieces. But if I can't trust that my teammates are doing that and then want somebody's going to go do something and test positive, now we're all paying the price. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a real life piece, but it could be anything. It could be being on time for a meeting. It could be, and then for me, it always transfers into your performance. So if I can't trust you to not cut corners in what we've identified as important off the ice or off the pitch or the water, then I question whether under pressure you won't try to cut corners when we're in performance. And then that affects all of us.
Yeah, very, very good point. So then how do you deal with people who, when you're building that culture of trust, like what you talked about, and when somebody comes in without a mask, what is the protocol then? Like they're on your team, so they haven't bought in. So then how do you manage that?
Well, for me, if we've done it right, that's not even something I manage as a coach. That's your leadership group, that's a teammate. It's however you set that up. Like for me, that should have already been talked about. And that's a great example of in the room we all agreed. So when we walk out, it shouldn't be anything other than, hey, Christina, put your mask on. A reminder. It shouldn't be the coach. As a coach, I don't want to fight that battle. I want to fight the battle where you want more ice time, or you want more playing time, or you want to roll in the boat, or whatever. I want to fight those battles. I want to have those discussions. I don't want to argue with you over wearing a mask or being on time, or those are things that as a group you come in and we work through it and you agree on it, and then let's leave our discussions to things that matter to performance.
And in those cultures of excellence, is that what you have noticed? Is everyone has bought into that? It's like that culture, whatever the culture may be, you've set it and now everyone has bought in. Or what you talked about before is like you're not going to get everyone to buy in 100%, but it's like their percentage that they're willing to give, they're still there.
And it's, percentage might have been a bad frame to use, but you're part of the team. Like if you're one athlete and that's all you're focused on, I think those discussions are different, right? But when you're a team of 12 or 15 or 18 or 20 or 25, like you've got to be willing to flex in certain ways for this team to operate, or this community to operate reasonably well. And every time someone doesn't sort of flex or act in a way that we've all agreed upon, that affects performance, because it makes the coaches question the trust they can have in you on the pitch or on the field or the ice. And it's distracting to your teammates, because if your teammates are all bought in, like they notice if you're not buying in, or if you're complaining behind closed doors. Those lead up conversations, trying to cover as many scenarios as possible before they happen. Plus your leadership group, like your leadership group has to be able to touch everybody. And at times that's where people miss, when they establish a leadership group or a leadership team, like you should be able to throw anybody's name on the wall, and somebody in that team should be able to say, I got her, or I got him. Like on his bad day and on his good day, I can get through to him, I can get through to her. So if it comes to it, long before it comes to you as coaches, we will have talked about it and addressed it and taken care of it. And lots of times that doesn't happen. So there's a group of people, it might be two, it might be three, it might be one, that nobody wants to take responsibility for on the athlete leadership piece. And generally they don't want to take responsibility for it, because those people are the ones that dance to their own tune and are difficult to be around or be a part of the team. And so everybody leaves it, but you can't ignore that. Somebody's got to do that, and somebody's got to manage it. I mean, athletes are far more accountable to each other than they are to leadership, like coaches or anybody. So at a point in time, the athletes may need assistance, or there has to be a revisiting of the culture, or whatever it looks like. But if you can get that athlete accountability in, and the athletes know you have their backs as coaches, and we've already talked through all of it, there's going to be bumps, but it's definitely going to run a lot smoother. And that's a lot of talking by me.
No, I love it. When you're talking about leadership group, are you specifically talking about athletes on the team that are leaders, or are you talking about IST staff?
No, like leadership group within, say, hockey would be, they wear a letter for the captain and they wear a letter for assistant captains. But that's evolved over time. The leadership group, in the late 90s, early 2000s, would have just been the captain and assistants, probably.
Okay.
But now a lot of teams have a leadership group where they don't necessarily wear a letter in competition, but they bring a characteristic or personality to the group that's needed. So you sit down with five or six of the team members as coaches, and that, you know, there's sort of that reporting in. So you got your whole team, and they meet with the leadership group, and they have their own discussions and their own pieces. Leadership group will bring it forward to coaches, et cetera. You know, so there's that. Every team's a little bit different on how they
Yeah, it's
manage
really
that,
interesting.
but it's certainly shifted from a one or two people as the leaders to a more of a leadership team, if you will.
Yeah, wow, interesting. I'm trying to relate this back to rowing, of course, and in university, that's where I kind of saw the differences when I came onto the national team. Like in university and all the other teams that I've been on, there are specific captains, right? And then once I came here, I realized that there was no longer, it was kind of like, and this is where it's also challenging to deal with personalities, because I found like on this team, then you have captains maybe from all these other universities or programs coming together and are now on this team. And so it's like, how do you navigate that? Yeah, that's interesting to see that in hockey, how you actually have a leadership group. And I think that there's probably a lot of benefits to that, and as long as everyone on the team sees them as that role and will respect them as that role, then you can also adhere to them when they have something to say.
Yeah, it's certainly like, you know, we're similar with hockey. Like every one of the, say the Olympic team, every one of them would have been a captain or an assistant with their university team, or, you know, so they all would have came in with having held those duties. The challenge is that if you leave it to be organic, the stresses it goes on to somebody. So if you have that person that's always willing to speak up and bring things forward, then sometimes what happens is everybody goes to them and complains. So now they're carrying, because they know they'll speak up. So one, it starts to show a lack of accountability in people in terms of their own willingness to speak up, and they put it on somebody else. Two, the person that absorbs all that, like eventually that gets pretty stressful, and you get tired of being the only one that'll speak up. And then how that person who speaks up is viewed in the eyes of the coaches, especially if it's all organic. Right. And you don't know that they're bringing forth team concerns for sure. You think they're just speaking. But, you know, that's one thing that I've always done. And one of the best things that, you know, Cassie Campbell used to do as a leader, you know, she'd come into my office and she'd be like, I'm just here as Cassie today. I'm
Oh,
not here as the captain, you know. And
yeah.
so what she was talking to me about was about things that were bothering her personally or things she needed to know personally. You know, another day she'd walk in and say, you know, I'm here on behalf of the team. And so as a coach, I'd have to separate the, you know, this isn't about Cassie. Everything she's talking about is about the team. People feel this way. It's not her. And you really, it's a mindset, right, to have those conversations around that. So, I mean, there's so many different ways to grow and develop leadership, but, you know, there definitely has to be a merge of how that all works within the team of athletes and then going into your coaching staff and your management staff or however it's set up.
And I mean, when I look at your previous experience and the success that you've had over such a long period of time and the teams that you've impacted, how do you what is going on when those teams are able to perform consistently on a very high level over a long period of time?
I believe belief in the preparation, so that everything you've done to the moment, you know, when you're preparing towards an Olympics, once you qualify, and in hockey, we've always had that, you know, that luxury, if you will, of having qualified a couple years out. Then everything's geared towards the final tournament, right? Or the final piece. So preparing them, and lots of times, you know, we discuss that we want the Olympics to be easy. So everything we do in preparation and situations is we're going to make it harder than it ever would be at the Olympics. So that when you go to the Olympics, it's easy. You're confident, you know, you're ready to go. You've lived the scenarios, we've talked through them. And, you know, I always said that when we, you know, when we got to the Olympics, my job was to try and stay out of the way and not screw things up. But you know, there's a lot of work that goes into that, a lot of strategic planning and vision and going through a lot of pieces coming into that. So, I mean, that's always been tough. The confidence factor is always something I've always struggled with, mostly because I'm always internally motivated. Mm-hmm. So I've always, I grew up, I was brought up, I'm responsible for my own confidence, mm-hmm. you know, and as a coach, unfortunately, it doesn't matter what I say or do, I can take that away or I can give it to you. Mm-hmm. You know, in hockey, if you're on the power play, you know, then that might be a confidence builder. If you come and talk to me about how you can get on the power play, I can give you a number of things that would help or will be better. But then if I don't put you on the power play the next day after you've done all those things in practice, sometimes the perception is that I didn't hear you as a coach, but in the end, I've taken away your confidence. Because in your mind as an athlete, even though it might have been only one day or 2 days or a week, you've done everything you can. So I should give you a chance on the power play.
Mm-hmm. That is so well orchestrated and absolutely true. And I personally struggle with that as well. And something that I deal with, which is like how I deal with that or manage that as an athlete, is bringing it back to what can I control? And so I believe, yeah, if I go to my coach and she says for me to execute this, then in my head, I'm thinking, okay, if I do those things, then I can expect to be put in whatever position moving forward.
Yeah.
And if I'm not put in that position, then automatically you're absolutely right. It's like you now are degrading what you just did and thinking, oh, now it's just me. I messed up. Like I did something wrong, or me as a person. And then you start looking at your own character rather than maybe there's actually so many other factors. And so I've tried to kind of manage that in throughout my career, especially being on this team too, which is like, okay, at the end of the day, I just got to do what I can control. And hopefully I do have that trust and building that trust with your coach that hopefully they'll see that in me. But as long as I can see that in myself, then sometimes I can't control where they're going to put me or what they're going to do. And maybe they have alternative motives because there's so many other factors. But I think establishing that as an athlete and realizing where that confidence comes from and where you want to kind of position it is such an important thing to do, but very difficult. And I think acknowledging that as a coach, like kudos to you, because I don't know how many coaches actually take responsibility and look at that and understand that they have a lot of control and a lot of impact on how their athletes manage their confidence and control their confidence. And I really appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
Yeah. It's just, it's so tough because it's like you said, and there may be alternative plans, but the problem or the issue is the alternative plans aren't personal. Mm-hmm. Like you might be a right shooting player, mm-hmm. and there are two players that shoot right that are better than you on the power play. So unfortunately, and as a coach, you don't want to say this, but unfortunately, if one of them got injured, you'll get a chance.
Yeah.
But if they don't get injured, all you can do is keep being ready in case the opportunity comes. Mm-hmm. But, and I know that's hollow for athletes that are trying to be at their best or trying to move, you know, through the stages, but that's where it's so hard for coaches sometimes to give that confidence. But at the same time, as a coach, if somebody has been building and doing everything you've asked and the door does open to give them that opportunity, you have to be consistent and aware enough to give that opportunity.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, realizing that it might be deserved for them to have that chance. But building that confidence in sport is one thing. And I think often, I feel like we're dealing with this now, seeing it more in athletes and when they transition out of sport and they lose that connection of, oh, I have this confidence in what I'm doing in this sport. But now the second I'm out of the sport, it's like, I don't have that confidence anymore because I don't know. All I know is hockey or all I know is rowing, and yeah. They've fixated that identity onto their sport rather than thinking and seeing that this entire life that they've had within sport has actually been a work in progress to then being able to use that, those skills in what you want to call the real world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for athletes, like there's so many resources out there, like on the transition out of sport. Like I remember one time in 2006, CSI came in and did their whole transition of out of sport presentation to our whole Olympic group. And they all the athletes made fun of me that I was sending them all a message that they all needed to quit or move on. But you're trying to provide them with the tools so that when you do hit those moments, hopefully something connects. Like, oh, we had that presentation back then. Who was that person I could contact? Or, you know, what should I do there? So, you know, I think there's a shared responsibility there, and it's hard for athletes in the moment to connect the dots. I recognize that. But as coaches, I feel like we have to do as much as we can to put those things in front of our athletes on a regular basis so that everybody's living it together, so that when the time happens for anybody, you know, they have a sense of that. You know, I like the fact that there's a lot of support through the COPC networks, that when an athlete retires or is transitioning out, there's people within that network that reach out to them. Mm-hmm. So I believe those are so important. You know, having your foundation, your pieces together, so that when you do have that conversation, hopefully somebody brings it back to what you've been doing, right? So mm-hmm. It's so hard to break through the athlete psyche on that initially. Mm-hmm. But as a coach, I feel like if I can just keep putting things in front of you that might connect or click when the time comes, that's all I can do. Like at points in time in the hockey program, we offered up and athletes went through the coaching programs, the NCCP coaching levels. And years later, like I'd get texts or calls like, Mel, you remember that course you made us do? They always say you made us do. And did I get a coaching number out of that? Like, how would I find that out? Where could I go? You know?
Yeah.
So they connected the dots at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it is tough. And I feel like the more we can have even athlete mentors, right, that mm-hmm. reach out and just, hey, I'm here, you know? Talk to me, let me know, here's some pieces. And we just got to continue to support all the levels until that person latches onto them, I guess.
Mm-hmm. How do you think athletes can best manage that or to build their confidence both on the ice or off the ice or on the water and off the water without allowing other people to impact them?
It's a great question. I mean, it's one of the challenges for sure. I always, you know, in one form or fashion, I always say, like, don't create stories in your head, like ask questions, you know, ask questions. And I realize there's a lot of different coaching levels out there, coaching behaviors and things out there where coaches maybe use their influence or their power in not an overly productive way. But at the same time, you know, trying to have those communications with your teammates, with your coaches, so that we get past the, they don't like me, or I'm not being given a chance, or there's personal agendas here or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So that you can focus on what's, like you said, focus on what you can control or feel confident or to build on those. And that's where the MPCs have mental performance consultants have such a big role. And it's still, in my opinion, the least used access we have by both athletes and staff, you know, on how do we get out of the fixed mindset into a growth mindset and, mm-hmm. and how do we use that? And I still believe we can dive deeper and be better in using mental performance consultants, both as individual yeah. athletes and the buy-in there, and in teams is how we position them and use that skill set and that expertise that we have, because it's invaluable and you never know when it's going to click. Like you just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I do want to be cognizant of time because you did say that.
Yeah.
11. Yeah. I had to shut it off. So I think I'll end it there unless if you have any last, just looking through my notes here, but any last words of advice or wisdom you want to bestow on any of us?
Oh, it's you know, just overall, like continuing to work on the communication and the clarity and having the courage to talk to each other. And if that means you have to write it down and you're just reading off of it when you're talking to a coach or to whoever, if that means you have to bring a teammate in to give you the strength, you know, whatever it takes, like have the conversations and be aware you may or may not like what you hear.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there won't always be the answer you want, but understanding for each side to understand where you're coming from is the only way we start to move forward together and in a productive, confident manner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Beautifully said. Thank you, Mel. I really appreciate this conversation. It's been very insightful for me. So thank you. Thank you so much. A huge thank you to Mel for taking the time to sit down and share your wisdom and experience with all of us. Thanks to my systems engineer, Sydney Payne, Claire Briand for background music, and a huge thank you to all of you for taking the time to listen to this podcast once again. Stay tuned for our next episode airing Monday, April 5th, where I sit down with two-time Olympian javelin thrower Liz Gleadle. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day. Go get after it.